You're listening to The Gold Standard, Episode 29, Jordi Savall, Music's Greatest Time Traveler.
Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Levine, and welcome to The Gould Standard, a podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation. Once again, we're bringing you conversations with some of the most remarkable people from all across the world of the arts. If film, books, dance, music, poetry, visual art, theater, and novels are the shot of positive energy that you need to stay mindful and present in these turbulent times, then you have come to the right place, my friends. But first, while you're stopping by under our celebrated neon piano sign, please do take a moment to press like, share, and subscribe. And if you just happen to be listening to us on Apple Podcasts, we'd appreciate your leaving your reviews, posing your questions, and being part of our community of friends and supporters. Be sure to check out our past episodes featuring such luminaries as Hilary Hahn, Michael Moore, Ai Weiwei, Sir Kenneth Branagh, Laurie Anderson, Viggo Mortensen, Barbara Hannigan, and Alanis Obomsuin. And to get more simply splendid sounds, witty words, and intriguing images, we'd love you to pay us a visit on our website, glenngould.ca. And when you're there, if you see that big glowing donate button, please press it and make a contribution. We are a Canadian registered charity, and we do appreciate your support. Now, friends, today we're going to go on a journey, a very particular kind of trip. We all know that many of the great technological innovations of our time began life in works of science fiction, which inspired scientists to get busy and invent the miraculous devices that the writers had previously dreamed of. But physicists tell us that one of the most popular devices in science fiction plots is simply impossible. I'm talking about time travel, the ability for people today to journey into the past. Well, I'm here to tell you that that's nonsense, and our guest today is living proof. Through music, Jordi Savall has traveled over a span of 1,000 years or more. His journeys have brought the accumulated riches of the human spirit, the triumphs, tragedies, and follies of the human saga vividly back to us so that we can experience them in the present. One of the things that I've always found inspiring about Jordi Savall's work is its spirit of compassion, its ability to reach out across cultures and eras to find that shared thread of humanity that unites people in times of joy, distress, conflict, and even catastrophe. Jordi Savall is the world's preeminent master of one of the most important instruments of the Renaissance, the viola da gamba, but is equally celebrated as the leader of three great ensembles that he founded or co-founded, Hesperion 21, the choir La Capella Real de Catalunya, and his orchestra Le Concert des Nations. Concertizing and recording prolifically together, they have explored the music from the 10th century to the mid-1800s and even more recently, and that repertoire spans across continents, making beautiful and startling connections that more than any other artist I know show that music is a universal language. Maestro, welcome.
Good evening. Good evening. A pleasure to hear you.
It's such a pleasure to be with you this evening. I'm going to start with something very, very basic, because our audience, many of them are not specialists in early music, and you are generally regarded as one of the foremost masters of your primary instrument, the viola da gamba. And although it kind of feels to me like asking Rembrandt what a paintbrush is, can you tell us a little bit about your instrument, the gamba, and a bit of its history?
Well, the viola da gamba, it's an instrument from the end of the 15th century, and it's an evolution from the medieval fiddle, the medieval bow instrument. The medieval fiddle has only three, four strings. And then the viola da gamba starts with five and then six, and then later in the 18th century with seven. I would say the viola da gamba is a sort of combination of the lute and the viol, of a bowed instrument, a plucked instrument. Like the lute, the viola da gamba has the same tuning. The Renaissance gamba has six strings, like the lute, in fourth, fourth, third, fourth, fourth. And like the lute, has frets. You can put your fingers and make the sound resonant. But in addition, the viola da gamba has a bow. But the bow, which played like the ancient bows of the medieval time, but also like all the bows from instruments played sitting. Gamba means length. Then you put the instrument between your legs, and then you pass the bow on the strings in the contrary way as you do with the violin. With the violin, you put your hand on the bow and you press. In the viola da gamba, you put your hand on the low side of the bow. You touch with the fingers, the hairs, and then you make pressure on the strings controlled by the fingers. And this is a fundamental characteristic. Other details are the viola da gamba is more light built as instrument, violin and the violoncello are more strong. The viola da gamba has six and seven strings, and the tension cannot be so big. But he has the particularity that with the viola da gamba, we can also sing and play so soft. It's very soft.
A true whisper.
Exactly.
So even though the gamba isn't an older version of the cello, which some people confuse it for because it's held between the legs.
Yeah.
You actually started off studying the cello back in the late 1950s and 60s in Barcelona. How were you introduced to the gamba and that incredibly rich body of music that went with it?
Yeah, I have to make the precision. I have studied music first, singing, when I was six. In the school was a small vocal ensemble, and I have sing and learned to sing with a much natural way. And then later, when I changed my voice, I was in the adolescence, 14 years. I have tried to play guitar, harmonica, percussion. I was a fan from Elvis Presley, of course. And I love to do music with my friends, jazz. And one day I was in a rehearsal. I discovered a rehearsal with the Mozart Requiem. And there was a beautiful vocal ensemble and string quartet. And in the string quartet, I was fascinated by the cello. And also I discovered the power of music. I was so touched by this music. I decided myself, if your music is so intensive, it can touch you so strong, I would like to be a musician. And I decided to study cello. And later, when I finished my studies, I discovered the viola da gamba. And then a new world opens to me because very few people play this instrument. This was exactly 1946, 45. And I discovered that this instrument, and then I go to Paris, to the Bibliothèque Nationale, to London, British Museum, Bibliothèque Royale de Bruxelles, etc. And I discovered a lot of music, but hundreds and hundreds of pieces who nobody plays. And this was for me a shock, because I was thinking I have continued to play cello and continue to learn a little bit of viola da gamba. when I discovered all this marvelous music, 5 books by Marat Marais, 6 books from Cadervola, Couperin, Santa Colombe, then English music, Sobeyesium, Jenkins, Ferrero's Coppers, and so many pieces that nobody was playing, I decided to dedicate my life to this instrument.
And by the mid-1960s, you went to Basel to study at the famed Schola Cantorum Basiliensis, right?
Exactly.
Under the pioneering gambist August Wenzinger. I've often heard him described as a really inspiring figure and a mentor. What was that study experience like for you?
Well, this was fantastic because August Wenzinger was not only a good string player, he was cello first. And then he plays also viola gamba. He was beside Arno Kur, Wilhelm Keuken, much younger in Brussels, and Johannes Koch in Germany. He was a great musicologist and a great also conductor for the ensembles. But as a viola player, he was a little, I would say, démodé, a little old-fashioned, you know, mixing the cello technique and the gamba technique. And I was very young in this time. Also, I arrived in Basel with my suitcase with all the music and all the letters, all the treatises. And my lesson was like this. Herr Professor, I would like to study with you, but I would like to make an experience to develop the technique of Marat Marais, Santa Colombe, according the rooms they explain in his books, in his treatise. Are you ready to help me with this?
You challenged him.
And he goes to study with the professor.
Right.
He says, no, I don't like to learn what you play, but I need to play in another way.
Right, exactly. So no romantic vibrato and no...
No, and all the techniques were specific for this instrument. I discovered a lot of things that nobody do, that the third finger with the pressure on the hands was called l'âme de la musique, the soul of the music, because it was a direct connection with the fingers and the body. But many things like this. And he accept. He said, okay, I will teach you like a conductor, like a professor. I will tell you what is wrong, what is not clear, what is have to be best. And it was a perfect collaboration. And 2 years later, I had my diploma.
And a big piece of the training for musicians studying early music is style, and obviously many styles over many periods of time. When you have an instrument like the gamba that passed through so many periods in its history, but I'm guessing, and you've already sort of referred to this, that a big piece of the process of your training and education was research and discovering pieces that had been neglected and in some cases perhaps hadn't been heard for hundreds of years. Do you find that still to this day one of the more rewarding aspects of your musical life?
Well, I think I have to say before, the most difficult thing when you learn an instrument, there's no teachers, living teachers. August Wenzinger, it was a viola player, but he has learned not from another teacher. The difficulty by this instrument is all the great viola performers have died at the end of the 18th century, the last died 1800. And then when we start in the 19th century, the pioneers like Dolmetsch, and they start from zero, only from the music.
Right.
There was no transmission. And this was the most difficult thing I see for the instrument. How I do this, I think I have to do a very special experience. When you learn something, you cannot ask a teacher how to play this. The only solution you have is to be very well informed about all the information, how the viols have played. For example, people say, the Les Viols de Gambe jouaient l'archer en l'air. The viol players has played with the bow on the air. What means this?
Yeah, what does this mean?
This means that you play the instrument and instead to do... you do
right.
one. You take the bow away and then the sound is projected like a pizzicato.
Right.
Many things like this you can find in the correspondence, in the treatise, explain how to play this. But this is not enough. What I have to do is start to play the pieces by Marat Marais every day, a new piece, and practice this piece so many days as necessary to learn the instrument. And then slowly, the music tells you what to do. The music selves explain you how to use your fingers, how to do, and the information of the composer, of course, because in the books are information. You have to play these notes a crescendo, here you have to play short, here you have to make an accent, there you have to do with your finger a vibrato, intensive vibrato, which is a blend or flattement, a lot of things. But the principal thing is to take the time to make the music tell you what to do. You know, it's very simple. And in certain way, it's like two persons, they don't know each other, they become in love, but they don't know each other. And then you have the dialogue. I tell the music what I like to do, and the music, it answers to me and say, no, what you're doing is not right. You have to play it slow or faster, or you have to be soft. You know, it's really a love dialogue. Like all the love things, very constant and passionate.
And it's really remarkable that it is the process of becoming familiar with the style and the way the pieces are constructed and the way a composer like Marais would use a certain kind of phrase, which tells you how he would expect you to lead up to that phrase and how to retreat from a crescendo. I guess in English, colloquially, we would say It's becoming zen with the music.
Yes. And later, I remember one time I was reading an interview by Stravinsky. He was working with a piano player in Paris for his ballet. And he was very nervous because the piano player has tried to perform this music so nice as possible and had too much rubato, too much things. And finally, Stravinsky says, desesperated, Monsieur, n'interprétez pas ma musique, jouez-la.
Right. Don't interpret, just play it.
Don't try to make an interpretation. Just play the music like it is.
Yes.
And such a way, when you perform a piece, you have no idea. You have to find first the why to perform without put your ideas. It's the only way.
Right. Now, the viol, whether as a consort instrument or a solo, has, as you mentioned, a 300 or 400 year history, but your repertoire extends far, far beyond that, much earlier and also much later, and across far more cultures. When did you begin to conceive of your exploration as having this added breadth, that you wanted to go farther back in history, farther afield geographically, and to touch on the musical traditions of more different peoples and nations?
Well, I think the fact that I'm born in Catalonia, in Spain, I have been in contact from my young time with three different, very different cultures. As you know, Spain was in the Middle Age a very important place for the Arabic culture. The Andalus was also a very important place for the Jewish culture until 1492.
Right.
And when I started music, I was also very interested with my wife, Montserrat Figueres, to explore the repertory of the Sephardic music. And when I started to play music also with the viola da gamba, before I know my wife, so I have accompanied Victoria de Los Angeles, the great soprano, in the first recording that he do with early music for EMI. And in this program, we have to do also Spanish Renaissance music and some Sephardic songs. And this inspired me because I found these songs from the Sephardic tradition so beautiful and so nice. And then I was, for the first time, conscient that we make sometimes an injustice when we put first, the classical music, the select music, the art music in a very high pedestal. And then we say, yeah, much lower is the traditional music. And I think this is wrong. Of course, the big compositions, the beautiful compositions from the great composers are very elaborate music and beautiful music. But a beautiful melody from a Sephardic tradition, from Armenian tradition, from Turkish tradition, from Arabic tradition, they are also full of beauty, emotion, richness. And I discovered this with the Sephardic music. And I also discovered why this happens. How is possible the simple melody can bring us so much beauty, so much emotion? And I think it's a very simple question. The people like the Sephardic, like the Armenian, like many people, they have suffered a lot in his life. They cannot survive without music. The music was the essential aspect to survive in the life. When a family of Sephardi goes from Spain, forced to exile to Istanbul, to Sofia, to Morocco, they have to start a new life full of difficulties. What they do? What do you do at the evening when you return home? They sing all together. And singing, they recover the peace and the hope. And this is the reason why these people and many other peoples in the traditional music, they can sing during 500 years the same melodies, because this music was necessary to survive. For this, I will say the importance from music, it doesn't depend from the number of musicians they play in a concert hall, the number of singers. Only one voice, if it's nice and sing with emotion, can give to you so much emotion, so much beauty as a big orchestra and a big vocal ensemble.
Absolutely. And you anticipated a question that I wanted to ask, because while you have performed and championed music from so many different parts of the world, the repertoires, plural, multiple, that you have perhaps been best known for and most associated with is the music of Spain, or the many Spains, the cosmopolitan crossroads of Christians and Muslim culture and Jewish culture that flourished before 1492. But also it was the music of Europe's wealthiest, most powerful court and empire. It's a country, it was perhaps became a country under Ferdinand and Isabella, but with a very powerful folk tradition and a very powerful dance tradition, very powerful poetic tradition. It's the Spain of Catalonia, your home, but also it's the Spain influenced by African culture with the beginning of contact with the Canary Islands and the Americas, because there was such a transference back and forth, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I guess it must have been just a great good fortune for you to be a Spanish musician, because it put you in touch with so many of these different crossroads.
Absolutely. This is some of the things I discovered also studying. When I was in Canary, and I discovered in the libraries a lot of villancicos, a lot of songs. Composers have composed for the church, and they invite in these songs in the church, because in Canaria, the ships, they have to wait sometimes 1, 2, 3 months before to start the big travel to the America because they had to wait until the weather was in the good conditions. And then sometimes there was there Spanish, Portuguese, Africans, Polish, French, Italian. And the composers, they have composed songs, which was the couplet, the strophes, in Arabic, in Italian, in Polish, in different language. And this is very fascinating. And then also in the influence in the New World, as you know, in the South America, in the churches, they invited always the slaves and the nativos to sing in the church. And the composers, they was using the material they have here from these people to compose songs with a very specific character.
Right, and I certainly am familiar with a type of dance that was imported from the Canary Islands, the Canarios, that was written in Spain. And also, I think I've read somewhere that the Chiacona was originally thought to be an American, a dance form from the Americas, or a rhythm from the Americas. I may be wrong about that.
No, well, this is a text from Lope de Vega. He says about the Chiacona, esta indiana amulatada que nos viene de las Indias. It's translated, this Indian mulat, this is the mix with right. Indian and black, who comes from India.
Interesting.
Referencing in the New World. The description for the Chiacona from this important writer like Lope was, this is the dance of coming. I think in the connection with the New World, it was always travel to America and back.
Right.
Probably a guitar player was played there, something. And then the native people, they like this music and they start to do something similar. And then the Spanish have made imitation and bring this back to Spain.
Right.
You know what was the first language who speak together, the Spanish and the Indians?
No.
The music. Also, I have another example. When Francisco Javier arrives, the Jesuit who arrives for the first time in Japan, he tell, we was like statues, we cannot speak. And what he decides to do, he decides to come to approach the Japanese people singing. And he has a start with all the community singing a hymnus. And this was the first contact. And this is the power of the music.
Your story is one of hard work and leadership and vision, but it's also one of collaboration and beautiful partnerships. The most important partnership, though, was the one that you had with your late wife, the magnificent soprano Montserrat Figueras. How did that collaboration start, and were there differences in your background and your approach? How did that just amazing musical relationship evolve?
This was very natural because in certain way, I was, as a viol player, I was very interested in the voice because I have read everywhere that the viol was the best instrument imitating the voice.
Uh-huh.
And then Montserrat Figueras heard my way to play.
Yes.
And she tried to imitate his way, and I tried to imitate her way. And it was a combination, for example, playing a Renaissance melody, and he discovered how this sounds with the viol. And when I hear a song from here, from another, I have also understand how the words, how the phrasing, it's influencing the instrument. That it was a good combination. And a long time we have learned each from one another. But also, Mozart Figueras was a big personality, a very special way to sing and to feel the music, especially the Sephardic music, the Italian music. And during many, many years, this was a very good collaboration.
Absolutely. In practice, in the development of programs, how did you collaborate? I have the sense that there were some of the projects based on the recordings that were her babies, the ones that she really took the lead on and championed, and that others were more ones that came primarily from you. Did she do a lot of the research projects?
Yeah, she has done a lot of research, especially the Brahms, who she likes especially. For example, the Nina Nana project, the Nuove Musiche, the projects with the troubadours, the troubadours, the projects, a lot of projects who was really engaged. And I was worked more with ensemble projects, with Monteverdi Madrigals, with Orfeo, with polyphonic pieces from... We start La Capella Real with Cerreroles, and then with Morales. I was more working in the polyphonic and the ensemble. She was more working also in his personal solo repertory. But we have combined both. I have worked also a lot with her with recordings like Merula or like recordings which the continuo and the instrumental accompaniment was also very important.
Her death in 2011 was really an incalculable loss to music. Hers was, I mean, the best way I can describe it is a voice of both earth and spirit, and really she had an unforgettable musical presence. It was such a blow. But you've also continued on from musical strength to strength, and it almost feels now as though her unseen presence is felt at your performances to this day, almost an implied tribute to her memory and her legacy. Do you sometimes feel that presence as you perform?
You know, my situation when Montserrat has gone, and in the first year, I was thinking, I will never do any more of this music, and I have never do. Song of Sibyl, Troubadours, all the solo repertory, Sephardic music, all these things.
Qui vos va chiller
But then I discover I cannot say I have just to put all the music, vocal music away, because I have then take this opportunity to invite singers from Brazil, from Africa, from Turkey, and then do this dialogue that she was also very affectionate, that we have do in the last recordings, like Mare Nostrum, like Jerusalem, like these things. And then I have continued to this exploration of the dialogue of souls, of the dialogue of cultures, you know. And he has inspired me in projects like the Ibn Battuta travels, like the Root of Slavery, many other things. Mm-hmm. But somebody with so much a strong personality goes away, you have to find another way to be creative. You cannot be always hanging with somebody that's not anymore existing. You have to make a final and then start again. The life has to continue. And I have always a respect and memory for my wife, but you have to adapt it in the new life also.
Absolutely. On a different subject, in the early days, and we talked a little bit about those pioneers in early music who were really coming out of romantic tradition, the Dolmeshes. And if anyone's ever heard the recordings of Monteverdi madrigals that Nadia Boulanger made in the 1930s, they're a lot different, let's say, than what we would hear today. But even as the performance progressed into, let's say, the 50s and 60s, you know, at least to my ear, at the start, things sounded a bit careful, a bit academic and dry. You talked about the lack of real improvisation. And over time, we've gotten to the point in the early music movement that it's real music making. It's very spontaneous. There are real virtuoso players who can play with great freedom. And you were really a big part of that transition. Did you sense that this evolution was happening all around you and that, you know, you were helping to drive it forward?
Well, I think my generation, which is the generation from from Franz Bruggen, then Gustav Leonhard, and then Ton Kopman, myself, and Harukur is more the generation from Gustav Leonhard. I think it's a start from a new generation who combine musical research, musicological fundamentation, and then virtuosity. I said, until our generation was more house music, in the sense music for everybody, and everybody tried to do the music so well as possible, so nice, and everyone is enjoying, but was not a musicological fundamenting and also not a technical performance. And I think the recordings from Gustav Leonhard, from Harnoncourt, from Bruggen, and myself later, demonstrate that the early music can be played so fast, so brilliant, so elegant as any modern music. Until in the past, this music was always giving a little bit an impression from something a little amateur.
Yes.
But
yes.
Amateur in the positive sense.
Doing it for the love of the music.
But not necessarily perfect.
Right.
To understand this, we have to remember one important thing. 1829, Berlin. This day, it's performed for the first time a piece who is already 100 years old, conducted by Mendelssohn, the San Matteo Passion.
Yes.
It's the first time that in the modern times, an old piece, except the Messias. Messias was always singing anywhere, but for the old repertories, and this was for the European, for the people from Berlin, you have to remember what important the culture was in this time in Germany, with the Goethe, with all Schiller, all the big poets and philosophers. This was a starting of a new world, really starting the renaissance of the music. But this has takes 100 years until we understand that the music has to be played with the instruments of the time, because this renovation of Ubers played with the modern orchestras, the modern ensembles, with the style of the Romantic. But then only in the 30s, people start to think, oh, maybe we need a real Baroque violin. And this takes still 60 years.
Yes.
And we have to wait until the 60s, the 70s, to find ensembles playing minimum, a little better, all these instruments, you know.
Yes,
and
then absolutely.
The reaction of this time also was because the Romantic has played everything free, everything too much rubato.
Yeah.
The first people they play early music, they say, no, this is to be very strong. No rubato, no emotion, no phrasing, because it's nothing written. Then you have to play this, no crescendo, no crescendo. And this was too orthodox and too dry. And then we have to wait to my generation, but we start then to see the freedom of the Baroque time. It's enormous in the players, in everything.
Another one of your really major achievements was the creation of your own record label. That was unusual for an artist in those days to establish a record label of his own. And of course, Alyavox is the label, and it is one of the glories of the musical world. Every release is a little work of art in itself. The designs are beautiful. The notes are beautiful. The recorded sound is beautiful. Of course, the performances, it goes without saying, are beautiful because they're yours. This has been a huge project. There are also these, you know, full-length books that contain CDs, like one on the Borgia dynasty and another one on Jerusalem, which is a really fascinating exploration of the different cultures around Jerusalem in the Middle Ages. What gave you this idea? Did you realize what you were getting into? It's not easy to be in the record business these days, I know, because I used to be in it. How many releases has Alyavox actually issued now?
Well, the first question, you know, when in the We started Alyavox in 1998. In this moment, it was a difficult situation in the market of the CDs. Start to be a little complicated to do recordings and to make money with the recordings.
Right.
And I have been impossible to confirm with my record label which project we can do next year. And a musician has to prepare the project 1 year in order to record the next year. If you don't have the confirmation, you cannot do the concerts. It was impossible. And then I say, well, I have myself as a solo, my wife as a solo, Esperion, La Capella, and the orchestra. If we do each year a recording from each from this, we have already a season with five different programs. And I have decided to take the risk to make our own recording and produce ourselves the recordings and create a beautiful album. Because when I proposed to do recordings with EMI, with other companies, you know what they tell me? Oh, Mr. Saval, yes, Tomaso Victoria is very nice, Montevideo. Nah, but we'd like to do a recording with Marin Marais. They would like to do again another Tous les Matins du Monde to make money, you know?
Right.
There was not interesting to do. Musicians, they are not so well known. And this was my idea. I have do in these 30 years recordings from Wilhelm Ross, from John Jenkins, from composers nobody knows or right. very little know in the public. And they've sold very well. And I think this was for me the most important thing, to be independent and to choose the repertory not according his economical rentability,
yes.
but according the beauty of the music and the interest in the music.
Absolutely.
It's a risk. And today it's much difficult because today we don't sell so many physical recordings. And the money that we receive from the platforms, from Spotify, it's too small.
It's nothing. Agreed. And honestly, for anyone who's listening, you can stream these recordings, but you're missing so much. I mean, to actually own them, to see the pictures, to be able to hold it in your hand, and the audio quality, of course, is better on a CD than an MP3. So I say, go out and buy an Olivavox CD, and then you will be hooked immediately and start your collection. You mentioned Tous les Matins du Monde, and of course that was, in a sense, the thing that no early music performer would ever have expected, which is a hit record. You had a hit record because of that film about the relationship between Monsieur de Saint-Colombe and his student, Marin Marais, the two great masters of the viola da gamba. And of course it starred Gérard Depardieu. It was a very successful film, but in a sense, it created or reflected a kind of mythology about the gamba as a kind of a vessel of a great spiritual message or a great spiritual force. And of course, the record sold over 1 million copies, which is inconceivable. Viola da gamba, 1 million copies. These two things do not normally go together. Were you surprised by this phenomenon?
And the moment we was very surprised because my complaints to the movie and to the history was, it's not any simple moment in this history, but Marin Marais can play a virtuosic piece, to play a spectacular piece like the Labyrinth, like brilliant pieces. We have choice because the history is very sad and very melancholical. We have Les Pleurs, La Rêveuse, L'Arabesque, very
yes.
intimate and very emotional pieces. And I was thinking, well, this was a movie for these small cinemas. But it was very surprising. A lot of people have seen, but also the recording before the film was presented was already sold in Christmas. Yeah, it was very impressive. And this was mostly young people.
Interesting.
Very surprising. Very surprising. I think young people discovered with the movie there's another type of music exists. Because the music from the people, the young people this time, it's pop music, very strong,
yes,
very loud. And they discovered the beautiful music they can listen at home with his girlfriend or reading or studying without to have so strong noise.
Right.
No? And I think this was a revolution for them. And that many, many young people discovered, but also normal people, I mean, from all the ages, you know, family. And was really very surprised. Thank you.
Well, one of the things that I think you can find in certain periods of early music, as in no other repertoire, and I'm thinking now about the Elizabethans and composers like Dowland, but also some of the music of Marais and Saint-Colomb, which is the most perfect expressions of sorrow. And sorrow is very captivating in a sense. And of course, for teenagers, you know, all of their emotions are very intense. So sorrow speaks to them.
And also, I have to say, in order to make an homage to Alain Corneau, he was in all the recordings nights, because we have recorded from 8 o'clock in the evening until 5 o'clock in the morning, because the church is the only moment the church was silence. And I remember a very specific moment, the moment who Marat Marais says goodbye to Madeleine. He goes to the cour, and Madeleine desperate, and after this he will suicide. And Marat Marais is there, and Madeleine say, "Please, play me La Rêveuse." And Marat Marais starts to play normal, and Madeleine said, "No, not like this. Play this slow, nice." And I was in the recording, I start to record the La Rêveuse like I do normal in the concerts. And then it's coming, Alain Corneau said, "Jordi, you make a mistake. This is not a concert." Here, it's the moment the Marat Marais saying, "Forgive me," to Madeleine in music. "Please forgive me." And he, "You have to play this with this emotion." And I tried then to be Marat Marais saying goodbye to Madeleine, saying pardon moi. And I had played in a totally different way that I have never played before. And I understand for the first time, sometimes you can play the music like an actor saying to be or not to be, to be in the life of this history, you know. And the result was this piece, which is 7 minutes long, was at the end of the film, with the credits, and I have seen many times the people remain sitting in the hall until the piece was finished.
And it's an exquisite film, whether historical or not. The emotions and the spirit of it is very, very true. And of course, it's now also available on AliaVox. So, you know, people who haven't had a chance to see the film, they can at least hear the film. Research and sources. I'm really fascinated by the periods where you really don't have treatises. I mean, I've read, for example, that you've been very influenced by Diego Ortiz's Tratado de Glosas on ornamentation, but your repertoire extends much farther back. And in those times, and even in later music, is that where folk traditions and the music of other cultures begins to fill in some of the gaps and allow you to get into that dialogue with the music where you can actually hear the music telling you how it should be played?
Everyday music from every tradition, has different sources. To understand a certain type of music, you have to go further in the roads of this culture. If you like to understand the music by Bach, you have to go further until Schultz and Josquin and the polyphonic music of the Renaissance. To understand the music from Italy, you have to know the music from Napoli. You have to know the music from Rome, from Venice. You have to be in contact with also the medieval time. It's a mix of these things, you know.
Right. And it is, in a sense, beginning to absorb a little bit of, you know, the mindset of people, what kind of a world they lived in, what kind of a social order, what they expected from childhood to through the arc of their lives. And that all feeds into the character and the spirit of the music.
Yes.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about Spain, because while Spain, of course, is a country of great and glorious traditions, it's also a country with many tragic elements. Of course, it was a nation of empire, of the Inquisition, of conquest and slavery, great tragedy and suffering. And you haven't shied away from those elements of Spanish history. Is there more to be done in music to serve the purpose of reconciliation, especially with indigenous people in the Americas, and in helping them, or at least respectfully approaching them in the celebration of their cultures?
Well, I think it's very few things really making correction to the, for example, the tragedy from the slavery. The most important slaves countries, they have made a lot of money selling human persons. They have to do any compensation. And this is a tragedy, because if today we have the situation that's still existing in Africa, Africa was destroyed by the colonization.
Yes.
Because they destroyed the communities. They take all the young people to the New World, and this communities was destroyed, and then was also destroyed by the enemies. And in the New World, some of the problems you can see in New World is the continuation of the theocracy we found in the 16th, 17th century. The power of the aristocracy, the power of the people, the rich people. These people are dominating. They are under control of the power.
Right.
They impose a religion. They impose the way to work. And I think mostly of the problems today that we have in South America, it's the result of many, many years of this lack of balance. But I think what Martin Luther King has proposed to the Congress, and the Congress has not accepted, will be the natural thing. And Martin Luther King proposed to the Congress to give to the descendants of the slaves special help to make possible that all the young people, they can study without pay. They can have the possibilities to develop his culture. And as a compensation from so many years working for nothing.
And of course, that kind of exercise of justice will not make anyone poor. It will make the world richer. Let's move on to Baroque and classical music, because with the establishment of your orchestra, Le Concert des Nations, a whole additional repertoire opened up to you, of course, performing some of the most famous works by Bach and Handel and Mozart, but also extending up to the 19th century with, most recently, a traversal of all of the Beethoven symphonies, the 9 symphonies. That has been seen as the Everest, the Mount Everest for conductors. And now you, coming from the world of, you know, Renaissance music and medieval music and, you know, playing the viola da gamba, are standing alongside the Toscaninis and the Leonard Bernsteins and so on. What did that feel like for you?
Well, first I have to say that before I have idea what the Viola da Gamba is, I was loving the music by Beethoven, principally. I was cellist, and my preferred music was Coriolan, was the Fifth, was the Eroica, all this music. I know these pieces by memory, like the Seven Last Waltz by Haydn. Then after many years working with my orchestra, when I was having the success of Tous les Matins du Monde, I have received a lot of money. And this was 1993. And I prepare at this time the Aliaga Symphony and the Eroica. But after this, I was the money from Tous les Matins was finished.
Yes.
And I have not anymore to pay a whole orchestra to rehearsal 2 weeks, which was my idea.
Right.
And I have to wait until now, with 2018, I prepared this project. I was preparing a project with combination of professional musicians and young musicians. But this is the project for Le Concert des Nations. Mix the professional that we have, that with young musicians from all the world, the best young musicians, and put in the orchestra and work, prepare one program in 2 weeks. In different 2 weeks.
Yeah.
We prepare 1, 2, 4, then 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 2 weeks working hard, 6-hour days, masterclass, sounds, articulation, working in groups, and then send the people home, practicing still, and then we'll start again 1 month later, a week, and then we do the recording and the concert.
Right.
This was my idea, but the idea behind this was to use the experience, my experience of 50 years, looking how to have to play a piece which I never hear before. Then I take the Beethoven symphonies, opening the manuscript, the autograph, and say, how can we play this? Looking the indications of metronomic tempo, the articulation indication, the phrasing, the dynamic, all these things, and say, well, we forgot what you have here from this music. We play this like for the discovery. And also the other thing that I have to do is the vision from the history movement. We come to Beethoven from Haydn,
yes,
from Mozart, from Rameau, from Bach, from the centers of history. The problem with Furtwängler, with all the great Calais, with all the great conductors, it's that in the romantic time,
yes,
in the most extremely romantic time, and they cannot imagine with this idea how can sounds, a work who was composed 100 years before in another context. And they apply to the Beethoven music the same style elements as you put it in Brahms, in Mahler, in Strauss, in Bruckner, and later. Yeah. And this is, I think, the mistake. It's a great performance, but the tempos, mostly of the conductors, they do tempos, they are much more too slow. And this is the thing that I don't understand, because all these are great musicians, but how they have the lack of respect. If Beethoven says the tempo is this, pam, 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 pam. Why they play slower?
Right.
Pa 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 pa. Beethoven says pa 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 pa.
Right.
Pa 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 pa. Ta 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 ta. They are a few, by chance, there are a few composers, Kleiber, that they have respect the style of spiel, but it's natural because in an orchestra with 120 musicians, you cannot have the same legerity, the same friendship with 50, 60 musicians, which was orchestra from Beethoven.
Right, exactly.
And also the other thing, it's the natural sound of the strings with gut.
Yes.
With classic bow. The sound of the flutes, wood flutes, oboe with wood, bassoons, clarinet, the sound of the natural horns, the natural trumpets. They are brilliant, but never too heavy, you know. This makes a discovering of colors, of articulation, of transparency.
And, if I had to describe just the sonority of the orchestra, I would say compared to most modern instrument recordings, I think of wood versus metal. There is such a warmth and an organic quality to the sound. It's very rich, it's very enveloping, and of course, I love it. So bravo to you on that. If I can take a moment, I'm going to indulge myself because I'd like to talk about a few of your recordings that are my personal favorites that have meant a lot to me, and perhaps invite you to say a few words about the making of them and the repertoire. So I think I'll start with the Song of the Sibyl, which of course is a great achievement of your wife, Montserrat Figueras. It's haunting. Can you tell us a little bit about, because it's music, when I first discovered it, that I had never heard of before.
The Song of Sibyl, it's one of the most ancient songs in the Christianity. And this was also going very far until the start of the religion. You know, when the Christian religion started, it was not well respected. And one of the personalities in the Rome, ancient Rome, who has a big respect from the authorities and from the politicians, was the Sibyls. The Sibyls was a special woman. They have the possibility to make prophecies. And it was a Sibyl who has said 200 years before the Christian time that from a virgin will come a boy. And this then was represented in the medieval time by a song in the church by a Sibyl. And what they do, the Sibyl, in the Christian time, it's announcing the apocalypse, the last judgment. This was the way also the Christian authorities used to remember the people, but not only the poor people, also the rich, that when Jesus is coming to judge us, everybody will equal in front of the judgment. So this was this music so popular because the melody is fabulous, it's very beautiful, but because they say to the people, you poor are equal of this man, the king. When God comes for the last judgment, you will both be judged about what you have done. And it was a scene of democracy in a time who the power has all the rights and the poor people know.
Right, right. And of course, the recordings contain versions from...
First, the Latin versions. The Provençal versions, the Spanish versions, the Mallorcan versions, the Valencia versions. It's a big diversity of versions with always alternation with the Sibyl and then the turba, the call of the people who say sometimes in monodic, sometimes in polyphonic, sometimes in the Renaissance side. It depends on the versions from the existing versions from different times, from the 10th century until the 16th century.
And the execution, the performance by Montserrat and La Capella, absolutely haunting, exquisite. Another favorite of mine, and this is a work that you've recorded more than once, is the Libre Vermeil de Montserrat. And that's a work that is kind of unique. I don't know of any other medieval music that is quite like it. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, you are right. It's unique because it's the first collection of music of the medieval time who contains Gregorianic songs sing in polyphonical position. The first piece it sings in a art from monodic rhythmical,
yes.
And you can sing in two voices and three voices. Thank you. then you have spiritual songs, dances, all related to the Virgin or the other, and in two and three voices. This collection contains the first polyphonic music, together with Notre Dame de Paris, with Codex Lasvelgas, and with some other monasteries in Italy.
Right.
And this marks the beginning of the European music language. You know, because until this moment, the European language was exactly the same as the language from Arab country, from Ottoman country, from Afghanistan, from monody and rhythmical and improvisation.
Right.
But never polyphony.
Right.
And with this collection, we start for the first time with the conductos and polyphonical pieces. And this is developed after this with Benchois, Josquin, Palestrina,
yes.
Etc.
All the way on through Bach and so on. And of course, the title, Liber Vermel, the red book, because the collection is found in a red binding in in the mountain monastery of Montserrat, which also is a shrine to the Black Madonna, one of the few places with the Black Madonnas.
It's Black Madonna, and also the chance that this manuscript survives to the Napoleon War was because this book was in Barcelona for restoring the print, and all the medieval manuscripts in Montserrat was burned during the 19th century war invasion of France. They burned the library, and this book was safe in Barcelona. And because it was this, we have conserved the music.
Right. And of course, I can't let it go without talking about the piece that you have recorded more than any other, because there are more versions than any other, and that's the Folias. You've done how many different albums of Folias in your recordings?
I don't know.
A lot. So, you know.
Well, it's a marvelous melody.
It is.
It's a marvelous, you know, it's really a very beautiful melody. And you can find the Renaissance folios, the folios from Spanish, from France, from England, it's a lot of beautiful pieces.
I wanted to ask a little bit of perhaps a slightly naughty question, but as you know, we are the Glenn Gould Foundation, and Glenn Gould was a pianist who did not play Bach on the harpsichord. He did one harpsichord record, but I think that most early music harpsichordists would consider his Handel record to be extremely non-historically informed. What would you say if Gould were around today to him about his approach to Bach or his approach to music making generally?
I have to say, first, I was very soon fascinated by the play by Glenn Gould, by not only Bach, but also he plays many English fantasies.
Yes.
With his piano. Beautiful fantasies. I have later played with the viol concert, and it was really incredible, beautiful. Still today, one of the Goldberg variations, or the My Preferred Goldberg variations, is the version of Glenn Gould. And I have another with harpsichord,
right.
which is between Leonard and Pierre Antaille. But in a certain way, in my memory, it's Glenn Gould variations, like a special moment of magical articulation of sound and phrasing, incredible, beautiful. I think it's perfect.
Oh, well, that's...
And I think the contribution from Glenn Gould to discover the sensibility, the purity of the articulation in the piano, inspiring in the old instruments, was a very important contribution.
I think he would have been very, very touched by that, and he would have appreciated it greatly. And I think that he would have, despite the fact that he never worked in the early music field, have been an enormous admirer of your work. Are there any dream projects, ones that you still really, really want to do almost more than any other?
Yeah, well, in the last dream I have already realized, it's the Unfinished Symphony by Schubert.
Oh, wow.
and the Ninth.
Oh, fantastic.
They were recorded last year in the same group of we have with the Beethoven symphonies. Now we are preparing the Mozart Requiem again. And we prepare this year also the symphonies by Mendelssohn, Italian and Scottish. We prepare from the end of the year Champartier Te Deo and Christmas Oratorio. Next year we do Missa Solemnis.
Oh, wow.
Beethoven. And Bruckner.
Bruckner.
Still
I was going to say, you're getting closer and closer to today.
You know, Bruckner is the most spiritual from all the symphonic.
I love Bruckner. But then when you get to Bruckner, you can't really say that the Furtwanglers are terribly mistaken because they're from the same tradition as him.
No. Of course.
Yep.
No. I will be a good student.
And I actually was unfair to you at the start when I made the introduction because I said that your repertoire went through the first half of the 19th century, but you've done some 20th century music too. I have one recording with you doing some of Arvo Pärt's music, for instance.
I have to with Arvo. I visited Arvo Pärt many years ago. And by the way, he was fascinated for the early music also. And I was in his home and we talk and we speak. And then I invited him to compose some lullabies for the recording Nina Nana for my wife. And he composed two beautiful lullabies.
Yeah, they are gorgeous.
And then 2004, when it was a festival about peace, I have commissioned him to write a composition about Da Pacem Domine, an old medieval song. And I invited to compose this song. And it was in March, a big, terrible terror attack in Madrid with 160 dead people. All the year I have called Arvo, I need your composition. We have the concert in April, please. And I, one day after the attentat, 2 days after the attentat, it's in my fax, it's arriving the composition. He was so touched about this drama, and that he has composed in the weekend the Tapachem.
Such a beautiful
and
piece.
And from this time, we play again the 30th of this month in Barcelona as solidarity with Ukrainian people.
That's really beautiful. And, well, thank you so much for taking this time with us. There you have it, folks. We have just gone through what, 1,200 years of musical history. I told you that we would be doing some time traveling. The earliest music that you've performed would be, what, about the year 800, I'm guessing, or 900?
Yeah, 900.
900, up yeah. through the 21st century. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. But I will say, I will like to tell you the words from Elias Canetti. Elias Canetti, in his book, Provinz der Mensch, in German, say the music is the through history, living history of the human being, because the music speaks our hearts. And when you hear a song from any other time, you feel the same emotions the people this time have. Then when you listen to a song of the troubadours, you are traveling to the troubadours' time. When you listen to a song from Monteverdi, you're traveling to the 16th century. And this is the great miracle of the music, what you have said at the beginning.
And there we have it. We have taken that journey, and I hope that those of you who are discovering this music for the first time, because there are still a lot of people for whom this is going to be absolutely fresh, pick up your crumb horn, grab your dulcian, your cornemuse, and let's get down with some early music. Thank you so much, Maestro Saval. It has been a joy to do this with you.
Thank you very much to you. Thank you.
And so ends our conversation with Jordi Savall, an amazing artist, an incredible human being. Rudra Priya, I hope you enjoyed our chat.
Absolutely, Brian. It was a fascinating conversation.
I have to say, I can't think of any artist alive in the musical world who brings so many different musical cultures together in one body of work. He's worked with artists in his ensemble who are Arab, Israeli, Turkish, Greek, Armenian, Afghan, Mexican, North American, and African. And it's no wonder that he was named an Artist for Peace under the UNESCO Goodwill Ambassadors Program. But now I understand that you have some vital information to impart to our friends.
Yes, the Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to continue bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca. And if you're interested in keeping up with the Gould Standard podcast and more work from the foundation, be sure to follow us across social media on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at the Glenn Gould Foundation.
And now let's return to Jordi Savall, and he can play us out with the single most covered song in music history, La Folia. Take it away, Jordi. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.